And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West. The most haunted city in the country. Well, this is December the 30th. 364th day of the year. Leap year is 365th. One day until the end of this year. And let me tell you, there's going to be so many people glad to see the back end of this year that they don't know what to say. Well, before I get started, I want to talk about something that just came to my attention. This new bill that was signed had an interesting caveat. It seems that there was a segment in it that required within 180 days of it becoming law, the U.S. government was required to release everything it knows about UFOs. I kid you not. So we're going to see what they have to say. If they got anything to say. Now, let us, on this date in history, which is December the 30th, tomorrow is New Year's Eve. 534, the second and final edition of the Code of Justinian comes into effect in the Byzantine Empire. Now, the Code of Justinian is one part of the Corpus Juris Civilis, the codification of Roman law, which was ordered early in the 6th century by Justinian I, who was the Eastern Roman Emperor. He ruled out of Constantinople. The two other units, the Digest and the Institutes, were created during his reign. The fourth part was compiled unofficially after his death, but is now thought to be part of it. He decided after he became emperor in 527, the empire's legal system needed an overhaul. If he could see the one we've got. 999, Battle of Glenmama. Combined forces of Munster and Meath under King Brian Boru inflict a crushing defeat on the allied armies of Leinster and Dublin near Lyons Hill in Ireland. 1066, the Granada Massacre. A Muslim mob storms a royal palace in Granada, crucifies Jewish vizier Joseph Ibn Nagrella, and massacres most of the Jewish population of the city. Now, the why is interesting. Joseph Ibn Nagrella was vizier to the Berber Taifa king during the Moorish rule of Al-Andalus and the Negrid, a leader of the Iberian Jews. He sent messengers to the ruler of the neighboring kingdom of Almeria, promising to open the gates of the city to the king's army if he promised to install Joseph as king in exchange for his submission and allegiance. But word of the plot got out. And when the populace found out about it, they claimed he killed the kings about to betray the kingdom. So they stormed the palace and crucified him. And then they went on a killing rampage, which is what mobs tend to do. 1419, the Hundred Years' War, Battle of La Rochelle. 1460, War of the Roses. Lancastrians kill the third Duke of York and win the Battle of Wakefield. 1702, Queen Anne's War. James Moore, governor of the province of Carolina, abandons the siege of St. Augustine. I mean, let's face it, you know, the party days were over and things were getting tough. British soldiers burned Buffalo, New York. Sad thing is, nobody noticed. 1816, Treaty of St. Louis between the U.S. and unified Ottawa, Ojibwa, and Potawatomi Indian tribes is proclaimed. 1825, Treaty of St. Louis between the U.S. and the Shawnee Nation is proclaimed. 1853, the Gadsden Purchase. U.S. buys land from Mexico to facilitate railroad building in the Southwest. 1890, following the Wounded Knee Massacre, the U.S. Army and the Lakota Warriors face off in the Drexel Mission fight. Now, this was an armed confrontation between the Lakota Warriors and the U.S. Army. It took place on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, December 30th, 1890. Fight occurred on White Clay Creek, approximately 15 miles north of Pine Ridge, where the Lakota were said to have burned the Catholic mission. 7th Cav, under the command of Colonel James Forsyth, with 8 troops and a battery of artillery, same elements that engaged in the Wounded Knee the previous day, became engaged by Bruel Lakota from the Rosebud Indian Reservation after reconnoitering to determine if the Catholic mission had in fact been burned. Now, these Sioux were said to be the same Bruel Lakota under Chief Two Strike that had attacked the 9th Cavalry supply train earlier that morning. In an investigation of the Drexel Mission fight, Major General Nelson Miles, the commanding general of the Pine Ridge campaign, criticized Forsyth for allowing his command to be pinned down in a valley. He submitted his findings as a supplement to his investigation for Forsyth's conduct at Wounded Knee. And the Secretary of War Redfield, a Proctor, set aside the Drexel Mission investigation and exonerated Forsyth of any wrongdoing at Wounded Knee. Basically, the 7th was getting cut to pieces when a battalion of the 9th Cav, Buffalo Soldier Regiment, under the command of Major Guy Henry, they were nicknamed Henry's Brunettes, responded to Forsyth's request for assistance. They drove the Lakotas from the commanding position on the heights and basically saved the 7th. 1896, Filipino patriot and reform advocate Jose Rizal is executed by a Spanish firing squad in Manila. 1896, Canadian ice hockey player Ernie McLee scores the first hat trick in the Stanley Cup play and the cup-winning gold as the Montreal Victorias defeat the Winnipeg Victorias 6-5. 1897, the British colony Natal annexes Zululand. 1903, a fire at the Iroquois Theater in Chicago, Illinois, kills at least 605. There may have been more, but they couldn't find the bodies in the rubble. 1905, former Idaho Governor Frank Stoenenberg is assassinated at the front gate of his home in Caldwell. 1906, the All India Muslim League is founded in Dhaka, East Bengal, British India. Later is Dhaka, Bangladesh. 1916, Russian mystic and advisor to the Tsar, Grigory Ilhamovich Rasputin, is murdered by a loyalist group led by Prince Felix Yusupov. His frozen, partially tied-up body was discovered in the Moscow River 3 days later. He had been invited to dinner, and his dinner is heavily laced with poison. It didn't seem to have any effect on him. So I think it was Yusupov ran in and shot him. And that didn't stop him. And eventually, they hit him in the head and drug him out and threw him in the river, which was iced over at the time. 1916, the last coronation in Hungary is performed for King Charles IV and Queen Zita. 1922, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics is formed. 1927, the Ginza Line, the first subway line in Asia, opens in Tokyo, Japan. 1935, the Italian Air Force bombs a Swedish Red Cross hospital during the Second Italo-Abyssinian War, and the hospital almost defeated them. Eventually, to win their invasion of Abyssinia, They had to call in the Germans. 1936. The Flint sit-down strikes hits General Motors. 1943. Subhas Chandra Bose raises the flag of Indian independence at Fort Blair. At Port Blair. The he was an Indian nationalist whose defiant patriotism made him a hero in India, but whose attempt during World War II to rid India of British rule to help a Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan certainly colored how everybody thought about him. 1944, King George II of Greece declares a regency, leaving the throne vacant. 1947, King Michael I of Romania is forced to abdicate by the Soviet Union-backed communist government of Romania. 1952, an RAF Avro Lancaster bomber crashes in Luqua, Malta after an engine failure, kills three crew members and a civilian on the ground. 1958, the Guatemalan Air Force sinks several Mexican fishing boats alleged to have breached maritime borders, killed three people, and sparked international tensions. 1972, Vietnam War. Operation Linebacker 2 ends. 1993, Israel establishes diplomatic relations with Vatican City and upgrades to full diplomatic relations with Ireland. 1996, proposed budget cuts by Benjamin Netanyahu sparks protests from 250,000 workers who shut down services across Israel. 1997, in the worst incident in Algeria's insurgency, the Wallala of Relazane massacres, 400 people from four villages were killed. In 2000, Rizal Day bombings, a series of bombs explode in various places in Metro Manila, Philippines, within a period of a few hours, kills 22 and injures hundreds. 2004, fire in the Republica Cromagna nightclub in Buenos Aires, Argentina, kills 194. 2005, tropical storm Zeta forms in the open Atlantic Ocean, tying the record for the latest tropical cyclone ever to form in the North Atlantic Basin. 2006, Madrid Barajas Airport is bombed. Also in 2006, the Indonesian passenger ferry MV Senopati Nusantara sinks in a storm. It's estimated at least 400 drown. 2006, former president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, is executed on this date in history. 2009, a segment of the Lazhou-Zhengzhou Changsha pipeline ruptures in Shaanxi, China. Approximately 150,000 gallons the equivalent of 40,000 U.S. gallons of diesel oil flows down the Wei River before finally reaching the Yellow River. 2009, a suicide bomber kills nine at Forward Operating Base Chapman, key facility of the CIA in Afghanistan. And in 2013, more than 100 people are killed when anti-government forces attack key buildings in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays, Christian Feast Day, Abraham the Writer, Anicia of Salonika, Edwin of Evesham, Francis Joseph Godet, Episcopal Church, Liberius of Ravenna, Pope Felix I, Ralph of Vocelis, Roger of Caen, Day of the Declaration of Slovakia as an independent ecclesiastic province in Slovakia, Rizal Day in the Philippines, the fifth day of Kwanzaa in the U.S., the sixth day of the 12 days of Christmas in Western Christianity. All right. Let's see what else we got. 987, French King Hugo Capet crowns his son Robert the Compassionate King. 1317, the pontifical degree, Sancta Romania, is done against a spiritualist. In 1621, King James I cracks protestation of Parliament. In 1703, Tokyo is hit by a major earthquake. 37,000 people die. 1809, wearing a mask to a ball in Boston is forbidden on penalty of arrest. 1813, the Danzig surrenders to Allied armies. 1835, the gold rush in the state of Georgia forces the Cherokees to move across the Mississippi River. Turns out North Georgia had a lot of gold, and the Cherokees owned the land. Little thing like that shouldn't stop anybody. And 1854, the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company, the first in the U.S., is incorporated in New York City. 1861, U.S. banks stop payments in gold, even though the currency used to say there's a dollar of gold on deposit to back this up. 1869, the Philadelphia Knights of Labor form. 1875, Andrasse Note calls for Christian Muslim religious freedoms. 1884, William Morris, Eleanor Marks, and others established the Socialist League in the UK as a revolutionary organization. 1888, in Belgium, King Leopold II installs the Order of African Star. 1896, Filipino nationalist Jose Rizal is executed by firing squad in Manila. It was on the orders of the Spanish. 1903, the American Political Science Association is founded in New Orleans. 1906, Iran becomes a constitutional monarchy. 1907, Abraham Mills Commission, after a great deal of study, declared Abner Doubleday invented baseball. 1918, the immortal John E. Hoover decides henceforth he'll be known as J. Edgar Hoover, first director of the FBI. 1924, astronomer Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope was named, formally announces the existence of other galactic systems at a meeting of the American Astronomical Association. 1936, the United Auto Workers staged the very first sit-down strike at Fisher Body Plant. And in 1936 is the beginning of the feud between comedians Fred Allen and Jack Benny. It began on Allen's Town Hall Tonight TV show. 1947, the Romanian Republic is declared. In 49, India recognizes the People's Republic of China. In 1952, the Tuskegee Institute reports that 52 is the first year in 71 years with no lynchings in the U.S. In 1959, the very first ballistic missile sub is commissioned. It was called the George Washington. And a very important date, in 1963, Let's Make a Deal debuted on TV. It was on NBC, as a matter of fact. All right. Having done our dose of history for today, you know, there is right now a very real possibility of, as of a few minutes ago, of war with Iran. It'll be interesting to see what comes of it. They've been shaking their spears for quite some time. Well, let's see if there's anything else. All right. We've been talking about strange crimes. You know, we're going to start out talking about the Biddle Boys. That was Jack and Ed. They were the Biddle Boys, leaders of a gang who relied on brains to commit their crimes instead of brawn. In 1901, the gang was robbing a house next to a grocery store. An accomplice kept the grocer distracted while the boys robbed the house. Didn't work, though. Grocer heard noise and went to investigate, and a struggle broke out. Shots were fired, and the grocer was killed. Well, the Biddle brothers fled, but police caught up with them. There was another violent shootout where a police officer was killed. And they were arrested, and they were sentenced, the Biddle Boys were sentenced to death. Well, the jail's warden, Peter Soffel, and his wife Catherine were in the midst of a divorce when the Biddles arrived. Catherine spent most of her time visiting the prisoners, offering them spiritual advice. She was called the Queen of the Jail. Now, she went to see the Biddles out of just sheer curiosity. Their exploits made them famous. And Ed's charm and good looks just won her over. Well, the warden knew his wife had taken an interest in Ed Biddle, but didn't realize how much of an interest. After a few months, Ed and Jack convinced Catherine they were innocent and convinced her to help them escape. Well, Ed's cell could be seen from Catherine's bedroom window, so they designed a secret alphabet code with which they could spell out messages about the warden's movements. So they asked Catherine to smuggle in two saws and a revolver. And so it was, January 29th, 1902, they broke out. As they were leaving the prison, they were met by Catherine, who was not part of the plan. Catherine, who was madly in love with one of the Biddles, chloroformed her husband. The warden woke up with a headache in an empty house. And he was told the Biddle Boys had escaped. He immediately knew Catherine was involved and put out an all-points bulletin on the fugitives. Well, Ed Biddle agreed to let Catherine come. They stole a horse and a slave from a nearby farm. They only traveled a few miles when a posse met him head-on. Ed and Jack jumped off the slave, each with a gun in hand. The lawman responded with a hail of bullets. Ed was shot twice. Jack was shot 15 times. Catherine was shot once by Ed after pleading for him to take her life. Now, Catherine's wound was treatable. Ed and Jack, not so much. As they lay on their deathbeds, they told police varying accounts of what happened. Ed claimed he'd never loved Catherine. He used her to help him escape. Catherine claimed Ed was saying that to protect her. And she had love letters he had written her while still in prison that backed up her story, but only Ed knew for sure. Me and Jack both died February 1st, 1902. Well, Catherine survived and died a lonely, disgraced woman in 1909. Doesn't say what happened to the warden. Well, if you watch Charlie Brown, you know about Linus and the Great Pumpkin. But do you know about the Great Pumpkin Mystery? It remains the most infamous prank ever pulled off at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. On an October morning in 1997, students noticed a 50-pound pumpkin speared through the spire of the 173-foot-tall bell tower. How it got up there and who put it there is still a mystery. But the real star of the story is the pumpkin, which stayed on top of that tower throughout the winter. It became one of the internet's first viral sensations, even spawning a Pumpkin Watch live video cam. Stories of the Great Pumpkin's resilience spread around the world. MTV even sent a crew over to cover it. Well, the pumpkin finally fell the following spring during an attempt to remove it. But that wasn't the end of the story. Parts of the carcass of the pumpkin were taken to Cornell's biology lab for testing. Didn't accomplish anything. Then, according to the Atlas Obscura, the remains were freeze-dried and kept in a glass case in the visitor center. Then added to a display of brains in the psychology department. Then added to it, found a permanent perch in the office of Professor Barbara Finley. Now, long since decayed, its legend lives on today, despite pleas on the prank's 20th anniversary for the perpetrators to come forward. They were assured they wouldn't be charged with any kind of crime. Nobody has yet taken credit. So if you were involved in putting the pumpkin on top of the bell tower, you're free to come forward. Well, let's talk about one of the first whodunits that I've read about. It's a murder mystery that came straight from the headlines of 1799. In December 1799, Gulalima Elma Sands got dressed and left her home. It was a boarding house owned by Elias and Catherine Ring. Never seen alive again, according to Catherine. She was planning to get married that night. Instead, her body was pulled out of the Manhattan Well. Well, suspicion fell on a carpenter named Levi Weeks. Levi lived in the same boarding house and been courting Elma. Scandalous situation for the day. After Catherine claimed that Levi was the man Elma planned to elope with on the night she disappeared, he was indicted for murder. Well, the trial began on March 31st, 1800. New York Evening Post editor wrote a transcript of proceedings, making the Weeks spectacle America's first recorded murder trial. After the jury was chosen, the prosecutor presented his case. Weeks moved into the Greenwich boarding house and seduced Elma Sands. He promised to elope with her in December, but when the time came, he changed his mind and killed her instead. Boarders at the Ring's home testified that Levi had been in Elma's room overnight a number of times. Catherine Ring testified the two had exited the house with a short time of one another. Witnesses said they'd seen a horse and sleigh near the crime scene. It resembled Levi Brothers Ezra's. Richard Croucher, a fellow boarder, claimed Levi's accomplice in New Jersey had confessed to the murder. Well, the defense, of course, portrayed the carpenter as an injured, innocent young man who'd never treated Elma badly. And Levi actually had an alibi. Several people had seen him at Ezra's house on the evening in question. Other witnesses said Ezra's horse and sleigh never left the barn. And a number of other boarders contradicted the prosecution's portrayal of Elma as a happy, innocent girl. They claimed that Elma used drugs and talked about killing herself. One boarder said Levi wasn't her lover. According to him, Elias Ring, the owner of the boarding house, spent the night with Elma when his wife was away. As for the prosecution's star witness, Border Richard Croucher, the defense showed he personally hated Weeks with a passion. Well, the judge bluntly informed the jury the prosecution's case was a flimsy basis for conviction. Jury returned his verdict not guilty. Now, a lot of New Yorkers disagreed with that verdict, and Weeks was eventually run out of town. Less than a year after the trial, Richard Croucher was found guilty of raping a young girl in a ring boarding house, which changed public opinion. Levi Weeks settled in Natchez, Mississippi, where he became an architect, married, and had a family. Since a point of interest you might like to know about, the Manhattan Well, where Elma Sands met her end, is still existing today. It's in the basement of the Manhattan Bistro in Soho. Well, Robert Mitchelson, Farmington, Connecticut, called 911 one day in February 2011. Dispatcher asked if there was a crime in progress, and Mitchelson said, well, possibly. I was just growing some marijuana and just wondering how much trouble you can get in for one plant. Well, the dispatcher was a little taken back, but responded, said it depends on how big the plant is. Mitchelson said it's only a seedling. Dispatcher informed him that having a plant of any kind does constitute possession of marijuana. Mitchelson thanked her and hung up, and the dispatcher, of course, called the police. They arrived at Mitchelson's house a short time later. Mitchelson told police there was no plant. He was just thinking about growing marijuana. But he was still arrested since he had a number of marijuana seeds, and several bongs. Let's talk about Ramiro Gonzalez, who was 30 years old, lived in Progreso, Texas. He was driving a tractor trailer filled with papayas in the far south of the state one day in January 2011. Sheriff's deputy pulled the truck over. After investigation, they discovered 3,103 pounds of marijuana underneath the papayas. Well, Gonzalez was arrested, of course, on felony drug trafficking. Now, he had probably gotten away with the whole thing if it hadn't been for the fact he forgot to renew the tags on his truck. That was the reason he got stopped in the first place. Had he not got stopped, they wouldn't have searched and found the marijuana. Well, when you're in prison, there are certain things that give you status. In most of New York's prisons, inmates are known for the single worst crime they've committed or been caught for. But a few prisoners also made names for themselves for what they did while they were in the prison. We got Lil Wayne, Grammy winner and self-proclaimed best rapper alive. He was locked up in Rikers. While he was in prison in 2010, he released the album titled I'm Not a Human Being, which shot the number one on the Billboard charts. He collaborated on a song with rappers Drake and Jay-Z, but he was sued by a record producer and posted regular blog entries. In the last month of his incarceration, he spent his time in solitary confinement. He was caught with contraband, don't you know? Wasn't drugs, wasn't weapons. It was an iPod charger and earphones. That's contraband. Then we got John Culp, brother of the revolver inventor Samuel Culp. He was locked up in the Tombs. Well, the day before Culp's execution in 1842, he married his housekeeper. Hours later, he committed suicide in his cell by stabbing himself through the heart. At the same time, a candle, another story says a lamp, ignited a fire that swept through the prison and destroyed part of the roof. And several prisoners escaped, and Colt's bride was never seen again. Sparking a rumor, she set the fire while Colt faked his death, substituted another body for his own, and escaped with her. That's never been confirmed one way or the other. Let's talk about a drifter by the name of Eddie White, who was locked up in Rikers. Well, by 1994, White had broken out of Rikers Island 3 times. He'd been locked up for the murders of 2 people and sentenced to 200 years to life. The breakout earned him the respect of the inmates, who dubbed him Rabbit Man for his quickness. One escape, he allegedly killed 2 more people, but those charges were dismissed when the judge noted he's already going to die in jail. The fascinating thing. And then we have con artist Tuvius Stern locked up in the tombs. June of 2009, Stern threw a lavish bar mitzvah for his son behind bars. Held in a prison gym, the gala had 60 guests, a band, and catered kosher food. Attendees are even allowed to keep their cell phones, which was a no-no in prison, and the jail paid officers overtime for the event. 4 months later, Stern threw another party, this time for his daughter's engagement. Well, when the city's corrections commissioner found out about the parties, he suspended the prison rabbi who'd overseen the bar mitzvah and took away the vacation benefits of 4 correction officers who'd been in on the event. Doesn't say what he did to the pregnant daughter. Well, in 1997, Christophe Mailly was employed as a night guard by an outside security firm responsible for protecting the Union Bank of Switzerland headquarters in Zurich. He discovered that bank officials were destroying documents related to the assets of Nazi Holocaust victims. So he took home some of the files that were going to be shredded, and he intended to save the documents and expose the bank's activities. At the time, investigations were underway concerning Switzerland's activities during World War II, in particular what happened to the dormant bank accounts of Holocaust victims. By law, the records were supposed to have been turned over to the victims' heirs. Mailly gave his files to a Jewish organization to reveal to the public what the bank was trying to do. In 1998, Swiss banks and Jewish officials agreed to a $1.25 billion settlement, of which Mailly received a reported $750,000. He was vilified by many in Switzerland for violating the laws of bank secrecy and was eventually granted political asylum in the U.S. What a strange world we live in. Well, let's talk about social media. Well, our first person is Rachel Sterringer, 19, of Keystone Heights in Florida. In 2010, she posted a photo of her 11-month-old son on her Facebook profile. And in the picture, the diapered boy appears to be smoking a bong. Which you might guess, the photo became an internet sensation. But somebody who was raised by a maiden aunt, a concerned citizen, called a Florida child abuse hotline. Police investigation was started, and Sterringer turned herself into the police. She said the photo was just a joke, and the bong was only used for tobacco. Sterringer was arrested, and Florida's Children's Services ordered that both Sterringer and her son be tested for drugs. The baby tested negative, but Sterringer didn't. She was arrested for possessing drug paraphernalia and was ordered to attend both drug and parenting classes. Then let's talk about Stephen Mulhall, 21, of Coral Springs, Florida. He was in a Broward County, Florida court on February 23, 2012 on a theft charge. That same day, somebody noticed a nameplate from the door Judge Michael Orlando had vanished. They couldn't figure out who took it. In March, an anonymous tipster called Broward County Sheriff Aaron Lamberti told him to go to a certain Facebook page. Lamberti did and saw a photo of Stephen Mulhall proudly displaying the nameplate of Judge Michael Orlando. Well, Mulhall was arrested for theft. Lamberti later told reporters the nameplate's only like $40, not that big a crime, but what an idiot. He's got multiple convictions for petty theft, so now this is a felony. Da-da-da-dum. Well, if you've ever watched TV, you've seen Dog the Bounty Hunter. Name is Dwayne Lee Chapman. He was a member of a biker gang called the Devil's Disciples. And they're the ones that gave Dog his nickname. In 1976, he was involved in a drug deal and went bad. Another gang member killed a drug dealer while Dog sat in the car half a block away. Well, he served 18 months in Texas's Huntsville State Prison for his role in the murder. And he caught his first fugitive while he was still locked up, when he ran down a fleeing inmate nicknamed Bigfoot to prevent guards from shooting him. Saving Bigfoot's life earned Dog the nickname Bounty Hunter and helped him win early release from prison. Well, he was soon back in court, this time for non-payment of child support. Seems he's been married 5 times, has 14 kids. While looking over his criminal file, the judge found a letter from the warden of Huntsville Prison praising Dog for saving Bigfoot's life. Well, this gave the enterprising judge an interesting idea. Showed Dog a mugshot of a fugitive wanted by the court for skipping bail and told him if he caught the guy, he'd personally pay the $200 toward his child support. Within a few days, Dog caught the fugitive and began a new career as a bounty hunter and a bail bondsman. An appearance on the 2003 A&E reality show, Take This Job, landed Dog his own series that debuted in 2004. It was soon the top-rated program on that network, and he has his own channel on Pluto, I might add. And let's talk about Julian Latouche. He got murdered. Even before the days of tabloid journalism, the public heard the grisly details of bizarre crimes of the day. This particular crime took place in the 1670s. And although the legal age for marriage at the time was 12, most families didn't encourage their children to marry at such a young age. One person who seemed to have a different opinion about the matter was Jacques Bertal, who had 4 daughters, is apparently anxious to get himself rid of. 2 of his older daughters are both married young, 12 and 14 respectively, and he had another younger daughter, Isabel, to marry off. Settled on a 29-year-old man named Julian Latouche, and he seemed to have a bright future. Isabel's mother, Gillette, had concerns and let her husband know she was opposed to the marriage. But Bertal asserted his right as master of the house to make the decision. So at age 12, Isabel was married. Julian turned out to be lazy, uncaring, and abusive, and couldn't provide the basic necessities for himself or his bride, and often he beat her. Well, her parents tried to provide them both with food and resources, but it's not hard to imagine that both Gillette and Bertal felt guilty about the situation. Something inspired Gillette to try and poison Julian with a plant that had killed some of their pigs. So she made some soup for Julian, who ate it all, but nothing happened. Next day, Isabel's parents visited Isabel and Julian, and Gillette entered the barn where Julian was doing something that seemed totally foreign to his character. He was working. Burst of anger that he wasn't dead, Gillette picked up a hoe and hit him in the head with it. He responded by attacking Gillette. Bertal entered the barn, grabbed a hoe from Gillette, and repeatedly struck Julian with it while Gillette screamed, "Kill him, kill him." Well, they drug Julian's body out and threw it in a nearby river. Neighbors heard the commotion and traveled to the barn where they saw a horrific sight of blood everywhere and even some teeth. Well, there was a brief investigation where Isabel and her parents were arrested for Julian's murder. Now, Gillette and Bertal confessed their role in the crime and both claimed Isabel was only a bystander. Isabel claimed Gillette was defending herself against Julian's attack. Well, unfortunately, the court decided all 3 were guilty. Gillette and Bertrand were executed, and just as Isabel had watched the death of her husband, she was forced to watch her parents' execution. Well, what happened to Isabel later on isn't really clear, except she lived with the notoriety of the murder for the rest of her life. Well, yep. Hunter Thompson once made the comment, going to trial with a lawyer who considers your whole lifestyle a crime in progress is not a happy prospect. Well, in February 2015, a light dusting of snow fell on the Amsterdam suburb of Harlem. Concerned neighbors in a row of townhouses called police to report that one of the townhouses had no snow on the roof. Well, Dutch police had seen this happen once before and had a pretty good idea what the cause was. When they investigated, their suspicions were confirmed. The hot lights from a large-scale cannabis growing operation in the attic had melted the snow. Occupants of the house were, of course, arrested, and the cannabis plants were confiscated. And one of the duly arrested individuals said, you know, we should have waited till spring. It is true that hindsight is normally 20/20. Well, in 2013, a Brooklyn entrepreneur named Howard Leventhal convinced investors he'd invented a medical tricorder. That's the device you saw on Star Trek that Dr. McCoy used to scan his patients. Leventhal, who was 56, called it Healthy O's McCoy Home Health Tablet. And according to what he said, the device worked something along these lines. You scan yourself, and then this vital information about your health is instantly sent to the company's nurse staff call center. Now, he didn't have a prototype. He didn't even have schematics. But he got $800,000 to develop the device. Well, unfortunately for the investors, there was nothing to develop because he made the whole thing up. Well, he was arrested. At his hearing, he said he pled guilty and said, you know, I'd like to move to Mars, but that option isn't open. It's interesting, little-known fact, DeForest Kelly, who played Dr. McCoy, his final role was a voice in a 1998 animated feature, The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars. Duh. I was at an event the last time Scotty came to an event. And I had one of those Star Trek figurines, and it was one he didn't have, so I gave it to him. He came over and got everything that I had that was Star Trek related and autographed it, which is something he never did. He didn't autograph things. Well, if you'd written the Turner Diaries, you keep your identity secret. Well, that's why William Luther Pierce used the name Andrew McDonald in 1978 when he published a book called The Bible of the Racist Right by the FBI. Now, it's a bizarre racist sci-fi adventure. It's set in the year 2099. In diary form, the protagonist, Earl Turner, describes how he and fellow members of a terrorist group known as the Organization brought down the American government and instituted a worldwide race war that ultimately eliminated all Jews and non-whites. It's unhinged, it's paranoid stuff, and it's sold about 500,000 copies so far. Dr. William Luther Pierce III was an assistant professor of physics at Oregon State University in the 60s, one-time leader of the National Alliance, which is a white separatist group associated with the American Nazi Party. In fact, their racist rhetoric made the KKK look tame by comparison. And he was also founder of Cosmotheism, a religion based on white racial superiority and eugenics. Among other things, the Turner Diaries is credited with influencing acts of violence and terrorism, including the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. He was known to have admired the book greatly. But when Pierce died of cancer in July of 2002, he was hailed as a prophet by some and as an inflammatory racist scaremonger by others. Yeah, well, for a man who saw life in black and white terms, he wouldn't have expected anything less. Well, in all August of 2017, police in a town of Osnabrück, Germany, pulled over a 51-year-old father and his 17-year-old son for suspected license plates. The pair acted suspicious, so the police searched the car and discovered 5,000 orange ecstasy pills in the shape of President Donald Trump's head. Now, that's interesting, to have ecstasy pills shaped in the form of Donald Trump's head. 2015, more than 120 statues of Shaun the Sheep, the beloved British cartoon character from Wallace and Gromit, were scattered throughout Bristol and London, urging people to donate to local children's hospitals. Donate enough money and you could own one of these unbelievable statues. For only £10, you could own a Shaun the Sheep ecstasy pill. Now, this wasn't part of the charity drive, but rather an attempt by some deranged drug dealers to cash in on the campaign. Several Shaun tablets were actually seized by detectives, but the culprits weren't never caught. It's interesting how quickly folks can subvert the best meaning projects. Well, Ted Kaczynski, the man who the FBI dubbed Unabomber for University and Airline Bomber, set off 16 homemade explosive devices between 1978 and 1999. He killed three people and maimed nearly two dozen others. His infamous manifesto shed light on two predominant themes that bounced around his brilliant but sick mind: a disdain for technology and a love for nature. After abruptly leaving academia in the 1970s to live in a cabin in the woods, he might have stayed there had bulldozers not raised the land around his Montana homestead. That was the impetus for the bombings. But the bad seed that led to the bombings may have been sowed a whole lot earlier. As a Harvard sophomore in 1959, Kaczynski participated in a twisted research study led by famed psychologist Henry Murray. Murray, in World War II, had trained U.S. spies to withstand intense interrogation. In the Harvard study, Murray's 22 subjects were told to write an essay outlining their personal philosophy, which would later be debated by a fellow student. Instead, Kaczynski, a 17-year-old child genius, was strapped to a chair under intense lights and electrodes were hooked up to his head. Then behind a one-way mirror, a camera recorded his angry facial expressions as a lawyer read back his essay, exploiting every perceived weakness and insulting and berating him intensely. Later, the footage of Kaczynski's reactions were played back to him ad nauseum. Murray's method of destructive psychology was by design vehement, sweeping, and personally abusive. Opinion is divided as to how this three-year study directly led to Kaczynski's crimes, but think about this. Henry Murray's theory of personality states in part that an individual's personality develops dynamically as each person responds to complex elements in his or her specific environment. And Kaczynski's response to complex elements was bizarre, to say the least. His targets, who he called agents of anti-human technology, were university and airline officials with nature-themed names like Thomas Mosser, Percy Wood, Leroy Rood, Bearson. Included in Kaczynski's crew bombs were pieces of wood and moss. Who knows how many more people would have suffered had the FBI not published the Unabomber's Manifesto in 1995. Kaczynski's estranged brother, David, read it and recognized that it's Ted's writing, so he contacted the FBI and blew the whistle on his brother, so to speak. Unabomber was arrested and sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole. Well, the next perpetrators, I guess you could say, were several officers in Miami, Florida. July 29, 1985, a group of men were attacked on a boat in the Miami River in the city's Little Havana district. Several of the men were either thrown or jumped overboard, and three died by drowning. An investigation found the men had been unloading roughly 400 kilos of cocaine when attack occurred. Further investigation showed that the attackers were actually Miami cops, and they were in uniform when they made the raid. Instead of arresting the suspects and taking the cocaine as evidence, they took the cocaine and sold it, made $116,000 in the process. More investigation revealed that same group of corrupt cops had been pulling off similar drug heists as well as a host of other crimes for years. Well, 34 members of the Miami PD were arrested, some of whom agreed to testify against the others in exchange for immunity. During the course of the trial, several of the arrested cops hired a hitman to murder the key witnesses against them. Unfortunately, you can't find a good hitman anymore. When it was over, 24 Miami cops were convicted and 17 went to prison. The longest sentence went to the leader of the group, Officer Osvaldo Coelho, who got 35 years. And interestingly enough, writers for the television crime drama Miami Vice actually based several episodes on this scandal. Well, you know, sometimes the best laid plans of mice and men don't really work out. Some people steal things from their workplace. They take pens or paper clips or pads. But when you're Gilberto Escamilla, you take fajitas and lots of them. He'd been working in the kitchen of a South Texas juvenile justice department for over 9 years when he decided to take a day off from work for medical appointment. While he was out, a driver from the Labatt Food Service called the kitchen and let him know he had 800 pounds of fajitas to deliver. The employees that answered the phone was a little confused. He said the kitchen didn't serve fajitas. Driver informed her he'd been delivering fajitas to the department for almost 10 years. Well, when Escamilla returned to work the next day, he was questioned about that food delivery. It's when he admitted he'd been stealing the fajitas. Now, remember, the county is paying for all this for the past 9 years. Apparently, he would sell the food to his outside customers the day he ordered it. Police got a search warrant and searched his home to find the packages of fajitas in Escamilla's refrigerator. He was fired and arrested for stealing somewhere between $2,500 and $30,000 worth of fajitas. He posted bond and got released from jail. Well, it wasn't over yet. After reviewing documents such as purchase orders and invoices for the past 9 years, the DA's office determined Escamilla had scammed the Justice Department out of $1,251,578 in fajitas. I mean, that made it a first-degree theft felony. According to Cameron County District Attorney Louis Sayens, if it wasn't so serious, you'd think it was a Saturday Night Live skit, but this was real. Escamilla was arrested once again, and you could say justice was served, and it was delicious. Well, there are those that swear this tale of Scottish cannibal clan is true. Others say it's an urban legend, but the tale's about Shawnee Bean and his family refused to die. According to legend, Shawnee Bean raised 3 inbred generations on the coast of Gallows in Scotland in the 15th century. And he sustained his family by attacking, robbing, killing, and eating travelers who passed by the family cave. First, he took only the odd traveler, but as decades passed and his clan grew, the death toll began to rise. When local villagers discovered odd preserved bits of bodies washing up on the shores near the cave, they hunted for the murderer. Bean and his family were discovered and publicly burned for their crimes on the order of King James of Scotland. The story might be hard to believe, but Scottish and British kids know all about it. Their mothers used tales of the beans to scare the kids into being good. And the story was also the basis for Wes Craven's 2006 film, The Hills Have Eyes. Well, on that note, we've run out of time, and we'll be back tomorrow when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall on The Ken Hudnall Show. Till then, have a great evening.